This podcast was recorded at the Blue Summit Water Conference.
It's now my great privilege to introduce our moderator for the first panel, and she will introduce the panel, and that's my good friend and my good sister, Sister Morna Ballantyne. Morna is the Director of Regional Operations for the Public Service Alliance of Canada, representing about 165,000 workers employed in the federal government, federal agencies, as well as in other parts of the public and private sectors. Prior to assuming this position, Morna worked for many years, over two decades, for the Canadian Union of Public Employees in a variety of roles. Most recently was our Director of Union Development. She helped shape the Decade Ago Conference, the conference held 10 years ago, and CUPE's campaign for public water, and was one of the initiators of our forging stronger alliances with all community groups, including the Council of Canadians. Sisters and brothers, welcome Sister Morna Ballantyne.
Bonjour, consoeurs, confrères.
Bonjour, brothers and sisters. I'm very happy to be here once again with the members of the largest union in Canada.
Back with so many members of CUPE, my home union, union I'm hugely proud of, Canada's largest union, and also to be among so many members in the membership of the Council of Canadians. I'm also a proud member of the Board of Directors of the Council of Canadians. Welcome to this first panel session on the state of Canadian water. We have about an hour for this session, and we're going to have a conversation, then we're going to open it up to some questions. And I'll go straight now to introducing you to the panel. So we have Ralph Pentland with us this morning, who's the acting chairman of the Canadian Water Issues Council at the University of Toronto. He's also a member of the Forum on Leadership on Water. And between 1978 and 1991, Ralph served as the Director of Water Planning and Management in the Canadian federal government and has extensive experience dealing with Canada-US transboundary water issues and has also worked as a water and environmental consultant around the world. In 2008, he co-authored a model act, the Canada Water Preservation Act, which is currently under consideration by government. Welcome, Ralph. Thanks for joining us. And ask you to comment, 10 years ago, when the very first Water Watch Summit took place, I think 1999, September 1999, a lot of the participants, we spoke about the need for federal and provincial governments to use their legislative authority to protect water resources. There was enormous concern at that time that not enough was being done at the government level, particularly by the federal government, to stop water from being exported, used as a commodity, not enough being done to stop the pollution of our waterways from water from being diverted and generally abused. So I'm wondering if you can share with us what governments have done to give us a sense of what is the legislative landscape in Canada right now with respect to water.
Okay. Thank you very much, Morna. I hope everybody can hear me okay. I'm going to just say a few words about legislation, but I'd like to start and cast it a little bit in a broader context of governance for a minute or so first. My general perception at this point in history is that over the last 20 years, our whole water governance system in the country has gone a long way downhill at the same time as the water issues have become more and more acute. And I'll hypothesize that the reason for that, the root cause of that, is that governments, national governments, haven't been able to adapt to the information age and globalization as fast as the private sector. And what's happened as a result of that is, with everything viewed through the lens of international economics, the broader public good has been effectively demoted. In 1987, I worked on the federal water policy, which was a good policy. Canadian federal water policy, which was a good policy, allowed as an example of the way things time might be done. But it couldn't be implemented because of severe financial constraint. Government came out with something called a green constraint. It promised an entirely new philosophy. The new funding showed up temporarily, and then disappeared along with a lot of other new funding. The new information appeared along with a lot of the philosophy was that government should do less than any. The new more information age philosophy was that government should do less and that enable more. That theory really remains largely untested. First, because it remains largely untested in national science. First, because the subsequent reductions in science knowledge capacity made knowledge less available to Canadians rather than more. Second, because international pressures aimed at impediments to industrial competitiveness made rulemaking less industrial competitiveness and less predictable. And third, because many of the public participation opportunities that were available prior to that time, under a whole lot of federal provincial agreements to participate. Because of all tools and strategies that were available prior to that time, which emanated from outside the water sector and even outside the country, under a whole lot of federal provincial capacities of the key parties that are responsible for Canada's water management are. Because of all those stresses, many of which emanated from outside the water sector and even outside the country, they're degraded or inadequate, or at best, these are the key uncertain. And the parties are less capable than responsible than ever at work working together. Canada's water key relationships of management are becoming either to degrade. There are a few bright spots at the local level, but they're inadequate or at best uncertain. The commitment to nurture them is. And the parties are less capable than ever at working together. Labor relations are becoming ineffective. General confusion and a few bright spots at the local level, but the commitment to nurture them is very limited. Clearly, we're in a state of just at a time fusion when the sense of gridlock, the national sense, just at a time when the national sense of direction is urgently needed. So, under those circumstances, it shouldn't be surprising to anybody that the chorus of calls for a new national water policy is growing louder. On the question of rulemaking and enforcement growing louder, there's been a serious breakdown in the earlier national consensus that we had elation during the first wave of environmentalism. On the question from rulemaking and enforcement, 1970 to 1990, the international competitive and test agenda is clearly to first trump the public good agenda of earlier decades. That trumping manifested itself minimalist 1990s approach in the more recent is so-called smart and crazy motion. Minimalist approach emphasized the reduction of smart government regulation. It put in place elaborate interference in private sector political and procedural requirements in economic activity. Which made adoption of new regulations virtually impossible. And there was a strong reliance on affected economic interests to regulate regulations virtually impossible. In practice, so-called smart regulation included the characteristics of the minimalist approach. But added the even more insidious idea of promoting the entities of explicit goals and entities activities. At its core, the federal government's explicit goal, external advisory committee defines the regulatory activity smart trees. At its core, the federal government's external as raising innovation and competitiveness to co-equal status smart regulation, as raising innovation and competitiveness to co-equal status with the press with tech protection of the public good. To the extent that the objective was to the extent that the objective was to make regulation more efficient, that was a laudable goal. But in my view, we went way overboard in virtually abandoning the precautionary principle and any significant amount of governmental enforcement, and by introducing economic board and virtually abandoning the precautionary analysis in ways that introduced an anti-regulatory bias. Economic analysis always overestimates the cost of regulation because we can't anticipate innovation. It always underestimates the benefits because we can't quantify them. A good example, I go back a little bit, is the phosphate detergent ban of the 1970s. If economics had been well, and any significant amount of governmental enforcement used to drive that regulatory decision, we wouldn't have done it. But we did it, and industry put forth many powerful arguments why it would be damaging to the industry and to the economy as a whole. Now, the suggestion is something like the public trust doctrine. Once that was in place, innovation kicked in, no environmental objective within the government. There were very large net benefits to society, and there were no lasting damages to the industry's bottom line. The industry due to sustain the essence of our water resources. So the use of regulation was, in fact, really smart. The head fake that Gillis was much weaker may have the potential of becoming a legal regulation, definitely, and he wasn't. Even from an economic perspective, if one ignores anecdotal and special interest studies, results from rigorous independent economics analysis suggests that strong and uniform relation has no negative impact for all Canadians, macroeconomic level. As well as those studies show that environmentally sensitive corporations generally outperform environmental factors in the stock markets.
Recorded at the Blue Summit Water Conference. The Canadian Union of Public
Employees. One worrisome aspect of our weakened regulatory regime is the uncertainty
it's created. A number of Canadians organized this
with respect to the longer-term human health.
Anniversary of Water Watch. The conference took place in Ottawa, November 27th to 29th, 2009.
For example, according to the Washington Center for Public Integrity, the IJC requested a study of the public health implications of hazardous substances in 26 U.S. states, 26 U.S. areas of concern. The center notes that various drafts of a 400-page report prepared by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention were reviewed by dozens of independent experts. But in July of 2007, just before it was to be released, the CDC's Agency for Toxic Substances withdrew it, saying it was needed further review. Also, according to the Center for Public Integrity, in many of the areas studied, researchers found low birth rates, elevated rates of infant mortality, and increased cancer rates. There could be a lot of reasons for that, of course. It could be caused by air pollution, lifestyle things. But in a robust democracy, you would expect the full disclosure of all publicly funded, peer-reviewed scientific findings, along with any relevant argumentation about cause and effect. We'll never be able to fully understand all the cause and effect relationships, but some things are certain. Adverse ecological effects from environmental pollutants occur at all levels of biological organization. The most serious of these effects can influence the ability of species to adapt to other stressors and community interactions, change ecosystem processes, or eliminate valuable species. In human-exposed communities, they can cause subtle developmental, reproductive, and possible immunological deficits that could potentially have profound implications for the population as a whole. Unlike budget deficits, those deficits can't be repaid, which is sufficient reason to ensure open and transparent processes and to practice the utmost caution. I'll just finish up with an idea from a great little book that I'll recommend to you, written by Marilyn Fair. It just came out, it's entitled Denying the Source, the Crisis of First Nations Water Rights. Marilyn suggests that it's time for us to ask ourselves whether we're willing to come together and demand of ourselves and our governments that water be treated as a sacred element of our world, that requires a higher standard of care, one commensurate with its unique status. She goes on to suggest that something like the public trust doctrine, the notion that governments have a fiduciary duty to sustain the essence of our water resources for the use and enjoyment of the entire populace, may have the potential of becoming a legally, culturally, and spiritually unifying concept for all Canadians.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rob. Okay.
This podcast was recorded at the Blue Summit Water Conference. The Canadian Union of Public Employees and the Council of Canadians organized the summit to mark the 10th anniversary of Water Watch. The conference took place in Ottawa, November 27th to 29th, 2009.